I'm sure everybody has heard of a singer, musician, artist by the name of Johnny Cash. Am I right? And evidently some fans. Well, one of Johnny Cash's last major hits, I don't know if you realize this or not, was not a song that he wrote at all. It was a cover song. And the cover was for a band that was one of these alternative rock, I think they call it industrial rock bands, called Nine Inch Nails. I don't know if you ever heard of them. And they wrote a song entitled Hurt. And so what you find is this country and western music legend goes out with his deep voice, and I'll say a Christian faith, and at times I think he was struggling pretty hard. But he covered this song by Nine Inch Nails. And folks, I guarantee you that was not on anyone's 2003 bingo card. That was completely out of left field. But it became a hit because when this man sang those words, oh my goodness, they were full of regret, and there's a lot of sorrow, there's a lot of pain in these things and things that he had done. And you just realize something, he wasn't covering this song, he was claiming it. It became his. And if you watch the video, you go on and watch the video, it is a powerful video. In fact, even Trent Reznor, who was the lead singer for Nine Inch Nails, who wrote the song, came out later on and he made this comment. He said, "That song isn't mine anymore. It now belongs to Johnny Cash." And in the music video, it's filmed just a few months before both June and Johnny Cash passed away. And so we see a man here who's lived this larger-than-life story in the entertainment industry. And now what you find is a man who's unbelievably fragile, and he's grieving what was lost. You see aspects of his fame, and he realizes that it's sort of fading. His strength is gone. There's one point he'll hold a glass of wine, pouring it out, and his hand just has a violent tremor because he can't keep it steady. His wife, June, is in the video, and she's looking on, and she's watching him in love, but she's watching him with this deep sorrow. And in so doing so, it's like she's looking at someone who's disappearing right in front of her eyes. It's heartbreaking. And the song opens with these lyrics. It goes like this: "I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real." And the music in this, it's slow, it's haunting. When Trent Reznor did it with Nine Inch Nails, it's distorted. It's almost meant to come across as someone who's trying to scream underwater. There's this immense pain that goes for it. The feeling, it's a lament. Job chapter 3 is Job's version of hurt. It's not over a regret based on what he did, though. Instead, it's the anguish of what has been done to him. And it's the cry of a man who's not looking for a way forward. He's looking for a way out, but he can't find it. So if you have your Bibles, go ahead and turn there to Job. In fact, you can go to Job chapter 2, beginning in verse 11. And just kind of give you an outline of where this is going to go. It's going to begin with the silence of Job's friends who are going to show up with him in his deep pain. But then it's going to move into the violence of Job's pain and how he expresses it. And so as we get there, let's first just kind of begin with our bearings, all right? Rewind what's happened so far. Job's living his life. It's his best life now. And all of a sudden, he's lost everything. And he's lost it within the span of just a few moments. His children, remember, he's got 10. They're all gone. And their spouses. They're killed. I can't fathom the idea of the loss of one child. You lose all of them. His health is utterly destroyed. His wealth and his possessions have been totally removed. And on top of that, his dignity even, I think, has been stripped away. And his life has just experienced this personal mushroom cloud over it. It's been completely nuked. And now he has nothing left. But here's what he does have. He does have some friends. Think about these friends as they live far away. But he's going to get a visit from them. I'll start in chapter 2, verse 11. "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite." Those are some pretty great names, aren't they? I can't decide if those are the best names for some sort of heavy metal band or some type of anti-anxiety drug that is out there. But they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and didn't recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each one of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. And then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Now, I want you to notice something, just a little observation and looking at that passage. The first thing you see is that these men are coming from different regions. Now, you know what that implies? This has been going on a while for Job. He's not been had this this thing affect him, and it's been about 4 or 5 days. Oh, no. This had to be long enough that the news left Job's home, went out to the lands, got to his friends. His friends then had to be able to communicate with one another from these different regions. Then they've coordinated events such that they're going to gather together, and then they're going to go visit Job at the same time. In other words, this has been months that Job is going through this kind of pain and heartache. And when they arrive, Job is so disfigured by his illness, they don't even recognize him. That is bad. They go 7 days, and nobody says one word. Not one. They just sit there. I'd like to suggest they may be doing something right here. Later on, we'll see they won't keep their mouths closed. But for now, that's exactly what they're doing. They show up, they sit in silence, and they cry with him. They're not crying at him. Little sidebar. Whenever you've got a hurting friend, someone who's going through something really hard, sometimes it's just the ministry of showing up that will do volumes for them, more than what you say. All this needed is just for someone to be present. Now, as someone who leans more on the teaching side, as a pastor, I got to be candid with you. I struggle with this because I feel like if I'm going, then this is inner thought, well, I need to say something to make it all better. I need to do something that makes everything, you know, seem like it's worth it, or help them go, okay, yes, I'm inspired. I can keep going on now. But sometimes in order to be, you got to be the hands of Jesus before you be his mouth. You got to learn how to minister in various ways. But don't underestimate the value of just showing up. As my wife has counseled me on this so many times. There's value in just showing up, even if you don't say a word. Well, for Job, some of these commentators believe that the 7 days, it wasn't just that they felt bad for him, that that's the period in that culture of mourning for someone who's dead. And so maybe it's possible that they showed up and they looked and you go, he is so bad, he is a dead man. It's just a matter of when. And so this mourning is sort of like he's already dead, and they just sit there waiting for this to happen and grieve for him as is culturally appropriate. But the problem is Job can't die. Because you remember what happened when Satan went to God and says, take your hedge that you have about him, remove it, let me at him. God says, okay, there's only one requirement. You can't take his life. Now, God knows that, and Satan knows that. The heavenly realm knows that. Nobody on planet Earth knows this, not even Job. So they have to all be thinking he's dying. Job has to be thinking it isn't if, it's when. But the problem for Job is he can't die, not in this. And so what he's going to do is he is going to writhe in pain as the living dead. And after the 7 days, he finally gets enough strength to sit up, and he starts to speak. And what he has to say isn't pretty, okay? If he had an Instagram in those days, he's not going to have an image of his feet, okay, in which he's got footprints in the sand poem transposed over that. It's not going to happen like that. I always wonder, why do people on Instagram put their feet up there? I don't get that part. But not for Job. What does he do? He's got some words that he's going to say, and they're not going to be the kind that are going to go viral or be inspirational. Instead, his words are raw. It's unplugged. It's unfiltered. So in contrast to the silence of the friends, we find out the violence of Job's pain. You start in chapter 3, verse 1. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. So Job, he doesn't curse God, but he does curse his birth and the day in which he came into existence. And I want you to look at the contrasting imagery. If you got a Bible and a pen, I'm going to give you some words to circle. If you got a digital book, this is the part that you're going to highlight. underline and circle or circle anything having to do with darkness in these next few passages. All right? Verse 4, he says, may that day, the day of his birth, be darkness. That's your first one to circle. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Nor light shine. Circle that. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Circle those. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. Circle that blackness. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Circle that. Behold, let that night be barren. Circle it. Verse 9, let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Another one. Let it wait for light but have none, and let it not see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. I'm convinced if this song had been put to music, it would have come in some sort of 90s grunge band style, where again, where the music is sort of off kilter and sort of, it sounds like a record that maybe is warped, and you would have the lead singer screaming all the lyrics the whole time. And Job's world has gone dark. Light. Light is what brings life into the world, does it not? We've got a sun out there, and because of the sun, photosynthesis can happen with plants, and thus plants can grow and they can live. For all of us, we get out there, it's a source of vitamin D for us. Light is what enables us to kind of see what's going on and around us in the world. It provides the heat that we need for our lives and for living. But here, he rejects light, and thus he rejects life. Job is in despair. The buzzword for today, Job has got serious depression. And for him, if light brings life, what does life mean but just more loss and more pain? Then he doesn't want anything to do with it. He wants to be free of it. So when he says, let the day of my birth perish, it's like he's saying, let's take the universe, let's unplug it, do a reset, plug it back in, only this time I'm not a part of it at all. Just leave me out entirely. In verse 11, now the why questions start to surface. 11, why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire? Now you got to remember, when the Bible talks about death, what does it call death? Our enemy. Death is our enemy. Here, he looks at the enemy and he says, actually, I think I can find comfort in being with my enemy. Because in death, here's what I've got. No more suffering, no more loss, no more death, no more pain. And it's so loud, I think that Job can't even remember all the good of the past because the volume of the pain for today, it just has completely stuffed it out for him. I do not believe him to be suicidal because he did not take his life. But I'll tell you what he is. He's exhausted. He's drained out. You ever been there? Some of you have. When pain makes you wish you could just take the reset button and hit it and have it reset, but without you. That's where he is. Verse 17, speaking of death, he says, there the wicked cease from raging, and the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They don't hear the voice of the taskmaster, and the small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Once again, pain has distorted his view of death. He no longer sees it as his enemy, and somehow he's almost looking at it as a type of a friend, somebody that is going to bring him relief. And it's here in about verse 20 where the second type of why questions begin to emerge, and that is, why must I suffer so painfully? Verse 20, why is light given to him who suffers and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave? You catch that? He's searching for death. He says it's like digging for treasures. In my own backyard, I don't know when, but it had to have been more than 25 years ago, somebody took these little glass beads and they dumped them in these various places of our yard. And when our grandkids come over, they've discovered a handful of them. So when they come over, they go and they find these places and they start digging. They call them their jewels. And they're so excited. They're looking for these jewels. Where's another one? Where's another one? Well, you take that and you turn around on Job, and he's not looking for jewels. He's looking for this thing called death. It's almost like saying he's digging his own grave. He would love to go ahead and to be lowered into it. And then in verse 23, you get the third type of why questions. And that is, why do I have to be hedged in like this? Verse 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food. He's not hungry for it. And my cries pour out like water. For what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. Remember, this is a guy who once had the divine hedge of protection from God, from these bad things happening to him. Satan even said, God, you put that hedge around him. Take it away. And so now God has hedged him in all right, but it's not in protection. This guy is hedged in pain, and he can't escape. And it affects his diet. It affects his fears. It affects his sleep. I've come to find that when people are often in deep distress, one of two things happens to their weight. They either gain it because they're looking for solace in their food, or they lose it because they're striving for some semblance of control. And with the volume of food they can eat is a means of establishing that control. But in both cases, it's looking at this problem and going, how do I deal with this? I don't know. In other cases, it's just your stomach is so upset, so just churning all the time, no food looks appealing to you. I don't know which one Job's in, but regardless, food, he turns away. He has a detest for it. And then I throw a challenge out to you. How many of you gone through a hard ordeal, and then you wake up in the middle of the night, and then you start thinking about it? I can't be the only one that's done this. Boy, there's something about the silence of the night that makes whatever it is you're thinking of gets incredibly loud at that point. And now the catastrophic thinking starts kicking in. And you're wondering, and you're afraid, and what if this, and what if that? And in some cases, what's the logical outcome of all this? And it just makes it worse. And this is where Job is in the darkness. In fact, all of it's sort of found in the profound pain expressed there in verse 26, when he says, I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet, and I'm not at rest, but turmoil comes. I like how Eugene Peterson rephrased this when he said, my repose is shattered, my peace destroyed, no rest for me, ever. Death has invaded life. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what lament sounds like. Have a great day. There's no filters. There's no cliches. No pretending. It's just hurt and anger and perplexity. Now, if you were here last week, you might remember Job's wife back in chapter 2. And she made this comment. She came to Job and she said, are you still claiming your innocence? Just curse God and die. She wants him to just say, just let God have his way with you, be done. I think she's viewing death sort of as like a friend as well. But let God take you. And one of the things that's interesting what he did with her is he didn't call her a fool. He said, you speak like the foolish women. He knew this woman wasn't a fool. All right, she'd been through all the stuff he had been through. She had just lost all her children too. She's trying to make the best reasoning that she can out of the circumstances and the situation that they're in. But he had married her. He had had many children with her. He had known her for years. He knew this woman wasn't a fool. But in the moment, here's what he sees. There's this discrepancy between what he knew to be true about his wife and the experience that he was having of her in that moment. And now what's happening is the same thing is going on with God that went on with his wife. Job has the same problem. What he knows about God is not lining up with what he's currently experiencing with God. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to suggest this isn't a sign of faithlessness by Job. It's a struggle. This is why the why questions even come up. Because of the incongruity of what it is that we believe about God and what it is that we're experiencing with God right now. And the faith and the experience are not in harmony. There is a distortion that is happening. And that's when you get Job's lament. That's when you lament. Now, there's a lot more that we're going to cover as we go through Job. But here, I'm just going to stop, and I'm going to ask, what are the kinds of things that we can learn as a result of this from Job chapter 3? Let me start with this. We got to remember this. First, lament isn't necessarily a weakness. It can be worship in the wilderness. It's the struggle. It's the struggle to try to find some sort of that harmony between what I know of God and what I'm going through right now. And they're not lining up. Job doesn't accuse God. He questions him. He asks some very hard questions of God. And one of the things that I find so encouraging in this Bible is God says, and that's allowed. In fact, it's encouraged to ask and to struggle with those kinds of questions. God is big enough for the honest questions that you have, for your cries, for your very loud tears, and for your hurt. He's that big. I want to remind you, in the book of Psalms, you've got 150 of them. More than 50 are laments. They're cries out of saying, God, I know who you are, but this is what life is like, and they don't line up. And I'm having a hard time connecting these two dots. And nearly all, except for one, they all come down to saying, but yet, I will land where you are, even though my experience doesn't yet line up. Psalm 88 is the only one where you don't get that resolution that yet I still will trust. You've got the book of Isaiah. Big chunk of it is laments. You've got the book of Lamentations. The title gives it away. Lamentations. It's just one big lament. On top of that, you've got Habakkuk. Habakkuk's got some very hard questions of God. A very short book, but some pretty significant questions that he says because he's coming to God and he's saying, I don't see things lining up the way I understand you to be, and I need some help. I need you to answer my questions. But they're not in alignment. And I think God in all this is showing us some things. He's showing us that what grief expressed looks like, and he's letting us know he understands. He does. And we have the freedom to express our disappointments. You ever pray like that? Let God know what the disappointments are. We have the freedom to utter our confusion, to tell him what's not lining up. We have the freedom, are you ready for this? To express our anger. We have the freedom to cry and to tell God what the hurt is. That's the kind of God you have. And he lets you come to him. He encourages you to come to him when you have this. God can take it. And we see it throughout the scriptures. There's a second takeaway that we can get out of this. And that is, we got to remember, and I've kind of highlighted on this already, but suffering often creates a dissonance between what we know and what we feel. All right? Job knew God is just. He knew that. He could give you the verses, you know, but it felt in the moment like God was actually cruel with him. And the tension isn't unbelief. It was going to be the place where a deeper faith in God would be born. There was an Anglican priest, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and he had some writings in which he criticized many Christians, are you ready for this? For believing not in God himself and who he is, but for believing in their beliefs about God. They believed in their beliefs about God. And does what we know about God always line up with who he is? Everybody say no. No, it doesn't. Sometimes we think things about God, and then when time goes on and we learn, well, we got a little bit of that from Scripture, but we didn't get all of what Scripture has to say about this. And now we've created God in this particular image, and suffering has a way of cleaning that out. A unique way of burning away some secondhand or maybe misunderstood, or maybe just some half-baked ideas and beliefs of who God is. And suffering is kind of fire. It's unlike anything else. It will burn like none other. I was talking with a man. It's been a while. I was talking with a man who had gone through a tremendous loss. It had to do with the loss of one of his children. And he said, you know, I've always believed deeply in the sovereignty of God. But now I'm asking the question, is he? And if he is, I don't know that that makes me feel better, because now it feels like he doesn't care. If he's sovereign, can I trust him? Because I wouldn't have allowed this to happen. Now, why would God do this? That, ladies and gentlemen, is part of the burning away that we get when suffering comes into our lives. You ask really hard questions. You do. And God begins to reveal new things about himself that you didn't know, or clarify things about himself that you didn't know, or about yourself that you didn't know. Third thing about this lament, I think that we can walk away with, and this has to do more with the ministry aspect, and that is sometimes people need a longer and an honest grief. and you have to give them some room. As Christians, too often we feel like you're not allowed to hurt and you're not allowed to express it. You got to be picture perfect and you got to keep a stiff upper lip and you got to keep smiling. And if you got a cell phone, there's only one emoji allowed on your phone, and that's the smiley face. You know, but all the others, those are off limits to you because you're a believer with hope. And here, what do we find? You can still have hope and still grieve, and your grief might take a while. It may take some time. It's a process. And God doesn't always just make you snap right out of it any more than he did with Job here, and you're done with it. You got to work through this at times. And when you do, you're going to have to be honest with God and about the situation. And I give you the reminder of how it began. God can take it. He can take your honesty. And then you're going to have to make that space for other people too who are grieving. And that's the one I think that's harder for most of us. Because it's sort of like, I don't like to see you in pain, so would you hurry up and get over it, please, so our life can get back to normal. And we can just get on with life, and then you can move, and you know, you gotta move past this. And you wanna help them, and you want to be patient while you encourage them and you help them. But you're gonna have to grant some space at times that may be uncomfortably longer than you would like. Now, for those of you that are struggling or that will struggle, a little warning. You want to be careful that in your grief, you don't cross the line between a lament and living in self-pity. You don't want to cross the line between a lament and a faithless defiance against God. You don't want to cross the line between a lament and some sort of sinful retaliation against God. It's a delicate balance of where you're going to go. And ladies and gentlemen, this is why when your life is good and your season is in a better realm, this is why it's so important that you have and you build the family of believers around you. People that you can trust, people who will come alongside you, people that will show you compassion, but will also say, you're not in a good place. We need to help you as you move from here to here. People that will be patient and maybe even endure some of the things that come out of your mouth that won't be right, but they won't let that sit forever. They'll help you. But it's a delicate balance. Lament is not permission, though, to fire God from his position and then take on the role yourself with your bitterness and with your rage. Be careful. Be real careful in your pain. There's a church in Lucca, Italy. San Matteo is the church. And they built this mosaic. A couple of people created a few mosaics on the floor. And the idea behind it is the sun comes in through one of the open windows in the church, it hits the mosaic, and then the light goes out from it and just shines the sanctuary. And it looks like stained glass from a distance. You see the blues and you see the reds and the golds until you get closer. And once you get a little bit closer, you discover that every piece of this mosaic is actually all it is it's broken glass. Every one of them is shattered and jagged edges. I'll call them painful pieces. And yet, when these pieces are arranged in the hands of the artist, it becomes beautiful, even sacred. This is what God does with our lament and with our pain. He won't always fix it. He won't always remove it. But he is big enough to take the broken fragments and to form something from it that we may never get to see in this life what that final mosaic is. Job didn't get to see. But God is trustworthy, even in your pain, even in your suffering, in ways that we just don't understand. But he is faithful, and he's doing something with it. Now, if all I had to do was say, just trust me on this, all right, whenever you're going through it, just trust me. If you're going through this kind of pain, you look and go, no, I don't believe you. I don't trust that. That's not good enough. Here's where I end with you all, and that is we do have a God that does know your pain. He does get it. He's the one who cried out with a lament on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? That, ladies and gentlemen, was pain. And in that moment, let me give you a suggestion for another mosaic. In that moment, Jesus became the mosaic, and he took on not broken glass, he took on broken people. He took on all our pain, all of our sin, all of our darkness, all of our laments, our Job 3 style laments, our prayers entitled hurt. And he took them himself so that we can know that God doesn't stand outside of our suffering. He's in it. He has stepped into it. He knows it all. And he's created a path for you and I to go from death to life, even in the midst of this kind of pain. Some of you, life is really good right now. Praise the Lord, you know? I hope it continues. Others of you, it's not going good. It's hard, and you're hurting right now. And if your soul feels like it's in the ash heap that you're here with Job, you're not faithless because you feel pain, all right? Don't go there. You're not alone in your lament. We all go through that. And your cries, no matter how broken they are, they're still going to be heard by the one who wept, Jesus Christ. And one day, ladies and gentlemen, the tears will end forever and ever. And he will be the last one to wipe them away from you. So he's trustworthy with your pain.